Renee Fleming has proved herself to be one of the greatest operatic sopranos, but she has been stretching her repertoire, tackling music that spans genres and centuries. In her latest recording, Poème, she performs four orchestral song cycles of the 20th century French masterpieces. It's released by Decca, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Renee Fleming back to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
You say no language gives you more pleasure than French, in general or as a language to sing in?
As a language to sing in. I really love the way it feels and how it helps me to sing better. I speak more fluently in German, and that's a language I love too because I find it so extraordinarily expressive and colorful.
But you don't do much Wagner, do you?
No. But Richard Strauss is the center composer for me now. But French, I just... I know that if I'm singing in French, I'm bound to be all lined up again by the time I'm done.
Just by the way the language sounds, the way the consonants follow the vowels and vice versa?
No,
I mean, it would be a lot harder in Russian, I'd imagine.
It's really the nasality of all of the articles, that combined with how fluid the language is. You know, it's an unaccented language.
Is it important to know a language that you're singing in?
It's really helpful. It's enormously helpful. And I'm only really in four languages, you know, comfortable. And everything else I learned by rote.
I just saw a film about the Metropolitan Opera's staging of the Ring Cycle. And Siegfried came in at the last minute, a young man from Texas, and he talks with a Texas accent, and then suddenly he goes out there, and as far as I can tell, is singing in beautiful German.
Yes.
So
yes.
I guess it can be done.
Absolutely. And in fact, I've had colleagues over the years who haven't spoken a word of any foreign language who sing phenomenally well in foreign languages. It has more to do with your sensibility, your ability, and also your willingness to work hard and how clear you can be in a language, because ultimately that's what audiences care the most about.
Your album's liner notes describe all singing as a form of storytelling, and that applies to the first song cycle, Maurice Ravel's Scheherazade, which is all about telling stories.
Scheherazade, 1001 Arabian Nights, and her survival depends on great storytelling. But what I love about these pieces, and the first one, Asia, Aziz, is incredibly pictorial in the description of all of these places in Asia that she is describing and wants to see. And the music follows in form. It's the longest of the three pieces. And they're all different. It's there is a reason why this is such a popular song cycle.
And the second song in the cycle, La Flûte Enchantée, begins with a lone flute, which we just heard at the beginning of this segment. Are there any particular instruments that you enjoy singing along? The flute is kind of in your vocal range, isn't it?
You know, what's interesting about instrumentation is one of the things I've discovered because I've been singing so many orchestral concerts in recent years is the harp seems to be the instrument of choice for the soprano voice. I'm always amazed when I sing a gala concert at what a workout the harpist gets. Flute is beautiful. Clarinet is beautiful. Cello, I love, because the cello is, and all the stringed instruments really are the closest to the voice.
Although the cello seems more like an alto range.
Yes, which is why it's a good accompaniment for me. You don't want someone performing in your same range.
The second song cycle, Olivier Messiaen's Poème pour Mi, was composed in 1936 as love songs for his wife. What about the cycle that makes those songs sound like love songs?
You know, it's funny. It's such an interesting cycle. First of all, it's one of the only examples I know where a composer has been successful at writing the text as well. And there's something so enigmatic about the text. The combination, it reminds me in that respect of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, because it's the combination of the sacred and the earthly, you know, in terms of, you know, spiritual love and physical love and, you know, personal, emotional love, which makes the cycle so interesting. And there's a tension created between that, in fact.
Well, you have this big orchestra behind you, and one of the songs, Épouvante, the orchestra sounds almost angry. It's very powerful.
Yes, yes.
Do you ever find it difficult to carry your voice over the orchestra, especially in a place like the Metropolitan Opera House where you're singing to I don't know, what is it, a fifth balcony?
Yeah, 4,000 seats. Of course it's challenging, and particularly now because orchestras are pitched higher, the instruments sound more brilliant than they did in many cases when the music was composed. And I would say there's with the sort of interest in the orchestra in general, as not as an accompanying instrument in opera, but as an equal partner in opera, the demand for larger voices has increased tremendously, even in the time that I've been singing.
Are you ever afraid of abusing your voice?
Well, I'm very careful in the repertoire that I choose. I don't like to feel pushed or pressured in that respect. It's not fun for me to sing loud all night. I'm more interested in an artistic, more expressive kind of singing. So, but interestingly enough, I do believe that 80 years ago, my repertoire would have been greater in those sort of more dramatic directions.
Well, of course, in Broadway musicals now, people are singing with mics. You
right.
think we'll ever see that in opera?
You know, I kind of hope not. I'm not a purist in any respect, but we're the last trained singers who aren't amplified. And there's something really special about hearing what the human voice is capable of in terms of, and it's the most athletic form of singing, the most virtuosic form of singing. And you can't really tell if we're amplified, that changes so much. It's the same as a recording. You can't really tell what someone sounds like on a recording.
And it sounds a little unnatural at times. In
right.
theaters. You say that you were both honored and perplexed when Alan Gilbert suggested that you sing Poem pour Me for his inaugural concert as music director of the New York Philharmonic. Why were you perplexed?
Because when I looked at the piece, I wasn't familiar with the piece. It was outside the realm of my experience. And when I looked at it, I saw that most of the recordings were from dramatic sopranos or dramatic mezzo sopranos. And so I just assumed it was inappropriate in terms of the size of the orchestration. Again, on a recording, it's hard to tell. And he reassured me, he had done the piece. He said, no, I really think it will be fine. And in fact, it's orchestrated phenomenally well, and it's less of a problem in terms of balance than half the things I do. So it was an absolute joy, and in fact, I really do feel that the piece can take a wide variety of kinds of singers in it now, and I absolutely love singing it. And audiences have been very open to the piece in a way that I think wouldn't have been the case even 40 years ago.
My guest is Renee Fleming. We're talking about her latest recording called Poem, or do I pronounce the S?
No, Poem is right. That's correct.
The album then moves on to the work of Henri Dutilleux, a colleague of Messiaen. Why did he request that you include you've actually dealt with him personally, and he requested that you include his Dessonnet de Jean Cassou in this album?
Well, we had such a wonderful experience together with Le Temps L'Horloge, which was the song cycle he composed for me, and we have such a simpatico relationship.
You described it as a hands-on
yes.
collaboration. I thought you were making a pun there.
Yes, no. Well, that too. You know, we get to hug a lot, absolutely. He's a phenomenal.
No, I meant Horloge, a watch, a timepiece.
Yes.
Has hands.
Okay. Oh, you've gone too far for me there. Very good. Very clever. He's just a lovely man, though. And I think the idea for both of us was that we wanted to continue to collaborate. And he thought of those two songs. And he also, I have the score where he wrote in what key he thought that the first one should be transposed to for me, which is what we did.
Do you feel some pressure performing the work of a composer who's living, in fact, introducing a piece?
Oh, definitely. A premiere is a responsibility that I take so seriously because the success of the piece, you know, that lives in a composer's mind is only realized when it's heard and interpreted by performers. And it's also the most exciting contribution I think that we can make.
Now, this album is a follow-up to Dark Hope, your rock crossover album of 2010. I would assume you're more comfortable in this territory.
You know, I'm comfortable in whatever territory I choose to follow only because I wouldn't try it if I didn't think it was worth exploring. And I consider everything I do artistically as some sort of adventure in a way.
But opera singers approach popular music differently today than they did when I was a kid. I remember Helen Traubel used to appear on some shows,
right.
And she would sing some popish song or a right. standard, and it always sounded like an opera singer
yeah.
singing it really didn't sound very comfortable.
That's been true all along, with the exception being Eileen Farrell. Because her I've Got a Right to Sing the Blues was, on a par with Ethel Merman in terms of just belting, just sheer vocal power and excitement. Typically speaking, very few people have actually managed to change their vocal quality and when they change repertoire. What's interesting to me is that the success of the crossover field of people like Josh Groban and Andrea Bocelli is a wonderful thing because they are singing in the style that we sing in.
But then do you have to change your mindset? For example, you recently returned to that album in a concert for a Live from Lincoln Center PBS telecast, and that was right after you had done Samuel Barber's Knoxville 1916.
Right.
And now suddenly you're doing an indie rock band, Death Cab for Cuties, Soul Meets Body.
You know, I remember being in high school and singing for a wedding and being in the back of the church and singing, Mozart's Alleluia followed by Evergreen or something like that, which dates me. And the audience was turning around and looking for the other singer, the second performer. So I've always enjoyed switching around. I mean, I think I even sang country western at a CB radio some sort of convention, and I played guitar and sang, Hank Williams. So I've always loved trying out other styles. But what I've found recently with Dark Hope, at least because we've orchestrated a couple of the songs, is that it's really fun in a big concert. It gives me a break, and it gives the audience a real break in terms of just switching gears. And people's tastes in music in general are more eclectic now.
You were married last September. Did you sing at your own wedding?
No. I draw the line somewhere. Yeah, that would be a bit much.
But introduced to your husband by Ann Patchett, who wrote Bel Canto. It seems really appropriate.
Yes. It's a cute story. And she is responsible for me meeting my now husband. And we just announced the world premiere of Bel Canto, the opera, in Chicago at the Lyric Opera.
You also are doing the creative consultant at Chicago's Lyric Opera.
Yeah, I'm having a wonderful time working with Lyric Opera of Chicago, working with Antony Freud, and trying to contribute in six or seven different areas. So that was an exciting announcement. And Yo-Yo Ma and I also just performed together for the first time in a flash mob setting at the State of Illinois building in support of the arts in Chicago public schools.
And because right now there's a sense that the younger generation is not all that interested in any music that isn't very much of their moment.
But
how do you open up their minds to the other possibilities?
My interest is more in young people having their own creative outlets, being able, and I don't mean just music, I mean in all of the arts, being able to explore who they are through that sort of sense of creativity. I think that's important. And if we put that aside, then that is a side of a human being that gets shut off. I'm also interested in them having exposure to all of the arts, and that means classical music as well as popular music.
Just one more thing. When I've had some musicians on the show and played their records, they start cringing because they hear all of the missed opportunities, especially jazz musicians. But what do you hear when you hear yourself?
I'm very involved in the editing and mixing process because, we're all perfectionists. We have to be to achieve what we achieve. And after that, I don't listen so much anymore unless I have to relearn it. But I try to tell myself it was a moment in time. A week later, I would have done it differently, and not to be too hard.
Renee Fleming's poem, by the way, Don't Change a Thing. Just been released by Decca, and it has been my great pleasure to have you as my guest on my show
joy.
Again.
Thank you so much.